Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's fiction podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. Parnell Hall is known to thousands of mystery fans and puzzle enthusiasts as the creator of Cora Felton, the crossword puzzle lady, who appears in a series complete with puzzles constructed by the New York Times' Will Shortz. But a much earlier series featuring Private Eye Stanley Hastings is what put the New York City author on the crime fiction map as early as the 1980s, and earned him a nomination for the Edgar Allan Poe Award. All of the book-length Stanley Hastings cases are now available on Kindle and on Nook. And here is Parnell Hall with a reading of one of Stanley's shorter cases, The Petty Cash Killing, from the November 1999 EQMM.
The Petty Cash Killing by Parnell Hall. I don't believe it. Uh-oh, that was a bad sign. All I'd done was walk in his office door. Since I'd known Sergeant McAuliffe for years and had walked into his office dozens of times, there was nothing particularly remarkable about it, which made the fact he was unable to believe I had done so all the more significant. I had a feeling I knew why, though I did not wish to voice it. Instead, I flopped down in a chair in front of his desk and said, "Gee, McAuliffe, what is it you don't believe?" McAuliffe took a cigar from his desk, leveled it at me as if it were a gun. "You, I don't believe you. Here you are, Stanley Hastings, walking into my office all casual-like, as if you were about to pass the time of day, when you and I both know that isn't true. You don't wish to pass the time of day? Don't be a wise guy." McAuliffe took the cigar, drummed on his desk. His doctor had made him give up cigars, but he still played with them from time to time, when he needed something to do with his hands, like when he had to restrain himself from hitting someone. "I made an arrest this morning, a homicide arrest, one Quentin Beasley, shot his business partner in his office late last night, Frederick Lowell, B&L Securities, office on 12th Street. McAuliffe cocked his head at me. "Any of that ring a bell? McAuliffe, can't you answer a direct question? Would it be too much to ask just for once, particularly since I was having a very good day until you dropped by?" "I certainly hope it continues." McAuliffe nearly gagged. "You certainly hope it continues? Well, why don't you help it continue? Tell me you have no interest in Quentin Beasley and that's not why you're here." Well, actually, McAuliffe said. He snorted in disgust. "The man asked for a lawyer. Not that unusual a request when one is arrested for murder, but he asked for a lawyer. And who does he call? A negligence lawyer. Not the best move when facing a murder rap, but that's okay with me. If the guy wants to be stupid, he sure has that right. And I'm actually happy as a clam until I learn which negligence lawyer he called." It was a surprise to Richard. "I'll bet it was," McAuliffe said. "And what did Richard Rosenberg do? Did he advise Mr. Beasley that he wasn't a criminal attorney and suggest that he call another? Did he offer to refer him to someone else, McAuliffe? Or did he take the case and send his number one investigator over here to abuse a friendship and interrogate me? Is that how you see it? Is that how it is?" It certainly was. Richard Rosenberg, New York City's most ambitious, tenacious, and industrious negligence lawyer, whose ever-increasing client list was filled by persistent advertising on TV, was actually a frustrated Perry Mason at heart, who loved nothing better than strutting his stuff in front of a jury. So when the Quentin Beasley case came along, he grabbed it and sent me over to work on McAuliffe, just as the sergeant had surmised, though that wasn't quite how I would have put it. "Of course not," I said. "I would never abuse our friendship. On the other hand, if we could help each other in this case..." "Help each other?" "If Beasley's innocent, you don't want the case to go to trial. Then you'd have to get on the witness stand and testify. You'd wind up looking bad." "With Rosenberg cross-examining, that's a given," McAuliffe said. "I don't mind looking bad if the guy goes to jail." "Even if he's innocent? Give me a break." "I'm trying to, McAuliffe. If the guy's innocent, I'll tell you first. I won't let you go on the stand and have Richard hand you your head. If I can prove the guy's innocent, not in legal terms, but enough to satisfy me, or more to the point, enough to satisfy you. I'll let you in on it, and you can act accordingly. And what if you can't, huh? What if you can't prove the guy's innocent? What if he's guilty? You know what happens then? Rosenberg takes me on cross-examination and tries to make me look bad in front of a jury, because he's got nothing else, and it's his best shot at getting the guy off. I nodded. Makes sense? Seems to me you're better off if he's innocent. Don't start with me. Come on, McAuliffe. Convince me the guy is guilty. What would you do then? I'd tell Richard to cop a plea. He'll listen to you? Not for a minute, but I'd be glad to tell him. McAuliffe scowled. Couldn't you have pretended he might listen? You're a hard man to please. Why don't you tell me what you know, so I'll get out of your office and you can get on with your life? Am I supposed to find your candor refreshing? Now you've done it. Tell me about the case, or I'll tell the other cops you used the word candor. Very funny, McAuliffe said. Here's the facts of the case. Mr. Beasley, who likes to play the ponies, had been dipping into the till. His partner caught him at it, and he killed him. You have any proof of that? No, we arrested him on a hunch. What sort of proof have you got? Come on, McAuliffe, convince me I'm wasting my time. You're certainly wasting mine, McAuliffe said. The records of the firm show that over the past 6 months, Beasley siphoned off close to $5,000 from petty cash. Petty cash? That's right. $5,000 doesn't sound so petty. It is when you string it out over 6 months. I'll tell you what we got, because it's no secret, and then you'll go away. We got a petty cash drawer full of bogus receipts. Bogus? Well, genuine receipts, but not for anything Beasley ever bought. These receipts tallied? Once a month. Tally check? On paper, sure. So what's the problem? The problem is, up until 6 months ago, petty cash had been averaging $200 a month. Suddenly it's up to $1,000. Bookkeeper smells a rat, mentions the fact to Frederick Lowell. Lowell freaks out, calls Beasley on the carpet, wants to know what's going on. What's going on is Beasley's stealing the partnership money. When Lowell catches him at it, he pops him. I frowned. What's the matter? A little simplistic, McAuliffe. He grimaced. I forgot. You grew up on murder mysteries. You resent anything simple and straightforward. I got news for you. In real life, 90% of the time, what you see is what you get. Innocent until proven guilty is a nice concept, but the fact of the matter is, most of the guys we arrest look guilty because they are. It was one of McAuliffe's favorite lectures. I ignored it, said, you got anything else on Beasley? The gun, huh? It was Beasley's gun, bought and registered in his name, kept in his desk drawer. He must have slipped it in his pocket at the first sign of trouble, which was when Lowell asked him to step into the bookkeeper's office. Oh, when was this? Last night after work. The way we dope it out, yesterday afternoon, the bookkeeper tells Lowell about the shortage. Lowell decides he wants to talk to Beasley alone. He waits until the bookkeeper goes home, calls Beasley into the bookkeeper's office. Beasley's suspicious, takes the gun. Lo and behold, Beasley's right, Lowell's onto him, confronts him with the books, threatens to go to the police. Beasley pulls the gun, shoots him. And? What do you mean, and? Well, what does he do then? Drops the gun on the floor and gets out of there. Drops the gun on the floor? That's right, that's where we found it, right next to the body. Well, that doesn't seem right. If he knows it's his gun, why wouldn't he take it away? McAuliffe shrugged. Maybe he doesn't want to be caught with it on him. Or maybe he's smart enough to realize the first thing the cops will ask him to do is produce the gun. Anyway, he leaves it there and goes out for a night of drinking and carousing. He arrives at work this morning to find the office full of cops, including yours truly, who places the gentleman under arrest. Who found the body? Bookkeeper. Arrived for work, opened the office, there he was. He called the cops? That's right. He's the one told you about the shortage? Of course. You have any corroborating witness? McAuliffe made a face. What do you mean, corroborating witness? We got motive, opportunity, we got the murder weapon. Beasley's not talking, and there you are. Perhaps it's a good explanation for these facts, but no one's providing it. If a suspect wants to remain silent, he certainly has that right. That way he can't incriminate himself, but he can't prove himself innocent either. Uh-huh, I said. heading off another favorite lecture on the failings of Miranda Escobedo. And who might this bookkeeper be? Winston Delmar didn't look like a bookkeeper, or at least my stereotypical idea of a bookkeeper. I had envisioned a little man with wire-rimmed glasses, a receding hairline, and a pocket full of pens. Winston Delmar was a flashy dresser with a wavy pompadour and a boyish grin. He had a one-bedroom apartment in a high-rise building on East 84th Street that must have run him a lot of money, seeing as how he was too young and the building too new for him to have lived there long enough to have benefited from rent control. Winston Delmar ushered me into a starkly modern living room that probably reflected some trend of which I was not aware, and indicated a rather uncomfortable-looking leather chair. "Please sit down," he said, "and what can I do for you?" I sat gingerly on the chair, found it wasn't as bad as I'd expected. As I said on the phone, "I'm the investigator for Mr. Beasley's attorney. I was hoping you'd tell me what happened." Delmar plopped down on the couch, ran his hand through his hair. "I can, but I still can't believe it. It was such a shock." "I'm sure it was. You're the one who found the body?" "That's right. I came to work this morning, 8 o'clock, same as usual. I opened the office, walked in, and there he was." "Where?" "In my office, on the floor, by my desk, lying there in a pool of blood, with a gun by his head." "By his head?" "Yes." "Was his hand on the gun?" "No, it wasn't. The gun was lying next to him on the floor." "Where was his hand?" "Which hand?" "His right hand." "Under the body." "Oh." Winston Delmar frowned. "Not that it matters, but he was left-handed." "Oh, not that it matters." "Where was his left hand?" "On the floor, by the gun." "By the gun?" "Yes, but he didn't shoot himself, if that's what you're thinking. He was shot in the head, yes, but not where you shoot yourself. A suicide, you point the gun at the side of your head, or you put it in your mouth. Freddie was shot right in the forehead, dead center. No one picks up a gun, turns it around, aims at their forehead. Still, it could be done." "Yes, but so what? Don't the cops have a test that can prove if someone fired a gun? Freddie wasn't wearing gloves. If he pulled the trigger, it would show. They'd be able to prove he wasn't, so you're wasting your time." "I see you've thought this out." "Well, what else can I think about? What a disturbing thing." "Uh-huh," I said. "You feel responsible?" He frowned. "What do you mean?" "Well, since you're the one who brought up the discrepancy in the books." He waved it away. "Can't think like that. Yeah, I told Freddie about the books, that there was a problem with petty cash, and maybe that's what he got killed over. But to say I'm responsible? What, I'm not going to tell him? I'm going to cover it up? Let things go on? Then I would be guilty of something." "Uh-huh," I said. "How long had you been covering it up?" Winston Delmar's boyish smile froze on his face. "I beg your pardon?" "How long had you known about the shortage before you brought it to the attention of Mr. Lowell?" "What's that got to do with anything?" "Well, you just said not bringing it to the attention of Mr. Lowell would have been covering it up. If you knew about it for some time and only brought it to his attention now, weren't you covering it up?" "No, I was not. I was merely being cautious. I was keeping an eye on petty cash to see if there was something wrong. When it turned out there was, I brought it to Mr. Lowell." I noted that under stress, Winston Delmar had stopped referring to the deceased as Freddie. "How do you know it was Mr. Beasley that was short?" "Are you kidding? It was his petty cash." "How do you know?" "How do I know? How do I know anything? It was his vouchers." "What do you mean, his vouchers? How does your petty cash system work?" "There's a petty cash drawer. The partners take money out of it, replace it with receipts. Once a month, they reconcile their petty cash. They take all the receipts, add them up, itemize them on a voucher. The amount on the voucher should cover the amount of petty cash they spent that month."
"And Beasley's vouchers didn't add up?"
"Oh, they did. They just got bigger and bigger and started to include bogus items."
"Such as?"
"Dinners that never happened. Office equipment that didn't exist. For instance, this month I found a receipt for $49 listed office equipment. But if you look close, the receipt was for Tower Records for 4 CDs.
"And you looked close?"
"I sure did. This was an escalating situation.
The amount of petty cash Beasley was going through was increasing every month. I was aware of it not only because I had to reconcile these petty cash statements, but because as a bookkeeper, I was responsible for keeping cash in the petty cash drawer. I did so by writing checks every time the balance got too low, which got to be more and more often. So your signature's on these checks? That's right. That's why I had to tell Freddie about it. I had to protect myself. Uh-huh. Tell me about these vouchers. Were they handwritten? No, they were typed. On a typewriter? No, a word processor. It's a program, actually. A specific form. You call it up, type it in. Prints in a grid. Pretty neat, actually. Uh-huh. And are these vouchers signed? Signed? No. Then how do you know whose they were? Are you kidding? It's typed on the form, part of the program. The signature is typed? It's not a signature, it's a heading. Right, but it's typed. Sure. Okay, I said. Let me ask you something. If it were actually Mr. Lowell who was taking the money out of the petty cash drawer, what would stop him from typing Mr. Beasley's name on a petty cash voucher? Winston Delmar's eyes widened. He couldn't do that. Why not? I'd know it. When two vouchers came in with Mr. Beasley's name on them. Yes, but suppose they didn't. Suppose Mr. Lowell waited until Mr. Beasley filled out his voucher, then took that voucher and added to it. Or wrote a new voucher, incorporating those receipts into it along with a bunch of others, and at the same time filled out a very modest voucher for himself. Wouldn't that create the situation you have now? Winston Delmore's mouth was open. I don't believe it. You're trying to prove Mr. Lowell was guilty? I'm not trying to prove it. I'm asking if it's possible. Possible? It's ridiculous. What, Freddie was the one dipping into the till? He got a sudden attack of remorse and shot himself? No. But if he was taking the money, it opens up a lot of possibilities. Say Lowell's the one taking the money. You go to him, tell him you've discovered a shortage. You suspect Beasley, but Lowell knows better. He's gone to great lengths to make you suspect Beasley if it ever came out, but still he doesn't want it to come out, because the one person who will know it isn't Beasley is Beasley. So Lowell stays behind at the office, not to confront Beasley, but to cover his tracks. Only Beasley is suspicious and catches him at it. Cornered, Lowell pulls the gun. Beasley struggles with him, and it goes off. Winston Delmar was staring at me open-mouthed. Are you serious? Absolutely. After all, you and I have no idea what really happened. Anything is possible. That's why I'm asking you. Can you point out any flaw in what I've just told you? Winston Delmore blinked. Is that what Quentin says he did? If it was, would it be true? Of course not. It's ridiculous. Why? Freddie wouldn't do such a thing. And Quentin Beasley would? Winston Delmore said nothing, set his jaw. I smiled. Come, come, Mr. Delmar. I know you don't want to speak out of turn, but it's important to sort out what happened here. You find it impossible to believe Frederick Lowell could be dipping into petty cash, but you have no problem believing it was Quentin Beasley. Aside from the name on the vouchers, which anyone could have typed, do you have any reason to prefer one to the other? Winston Delmar squirmed. I don't like this. Me neither, but the cards are on the table. You already told the cops about the shortage, and you told them it was Beasley who was short. You got anything to back that up? I put up my hand. You understand something. You're not under oath, and I'm not talking about what can be legally proved. Just between you and me, how come you think it's Beasley? Just between you and me? Please. His lifestyle. Winston Delmar shrugged. I already told this to the cops. It's no secret. Quentin Beasley likes to party. I've seen him myself, out on the town with a number of women. He's a bachelor? Divorced. Paying alimony and playing the field. Not to mention the ponies. The ponies? Sure. Beasley's a gambler. And frankly, not a very good one. Always playing long shots that don't come in. How do you know this? How do I know anything? There's an OTB right on our corner. Beasley likes to stop in on the lunch hour, get some money down. Almost every day. How do you know they're long shots? I'd ask him now and then. What did you bet on? It was always some dog. And the one or two times he did manage to hit, he'd brag about it to anyone in sight. Plus you'd seen him in the OTB yourself?
That's right.
Interesting, I said. You know anything about the gun?
Sure, it's Quentin's gun. He bragged about it, too. Kept it in his desk drawer. Took it with him when he had to carry large quantities of cash.
Winston Delmar smiled, which wasn't often with his track record. Still, the time that long shot came in, he flashed the cash around the office, made a show of wearing the gun home.
He bring it back the next day?
Oh, sure, he made a show of that, too. Came in, put the gun in the drawer, announced that thanks to it, no one had held him up. As if anyone cared.
And this is the gun that killed Mr. Lowell?
That's right.
How do you know?
I beg your pardon.
How do you know it's Beasley's gun?
Did you recognize it?
Oh, sure. The police will do the ballistics works, whatever it is, match up the bullet. But hey, it's his gun. 32 Smith & Wesson revolver, just like his. Plus, his gun's missing from the drawer.
Winston Delmar shrugged.
You do the math.
I see, I said.
You tell all this to the police?
Of course. It's a murder investigation. I'm not going to lie.
I wondered about that.
Richard Rosenberg wasn't impressed.
This? You bring me this?
Why don't you bring me something I can use?
Are you kidding? I thought you'd be pleased.
Pleased? Why should I be pleased?
Richard Rosenberg got up from his desk and began to pace around his office.
A little man, he burned up twice the calories of a big man through the expenditure of a seemingly inexhaustible amount of nervous energy. Rosenberg was a demon in court, whom opposing counsel went out of their way to avoid. His out-of-court settlements were large, his in-court settlements legendary. Dealing with him was never easy, but through the years I'd learned to take the verbal pummeling in my stride.
Are you kidding me? I said. You should be pleased to have something to argue.
Richard opened his mouth. I held up my hand. Not that you wouldn't anyway. I am aware you were capable of contending these petty cash vouchers weren't Quentin Beasley's, even if he'd had them signed and notarized. But this is so much better than that. The forms were typed on a computer. Anyone could have done it.
Including the deceased Mr. Lowell? Richard said ironically.
Why not?
All right, let's examine why not. Make me a case against Frederick Lowell.
You think his death exonerates him?
Of course not. It just makes him harder to prosecute. But that's not my worry. Go ahead. Sell me on the fact Lowell did it.
I gave Richard a summary of the theory I'd outlined for Winston Delmar. That Lowell was the embezzler, that Beasley caught him at it, Lowell tried to kill him, and Beasley shot him in self-defense. When I was finished, Richard frowned.
I can't say I like that theory much.
No.
No.
Particularly when the bookkeeper himself is a much more likely candidate.
Oh?
Richard sat on the edge of his desk, twiddled his thumbs.
Absolutely, he said. Who would know better how to manipulate the petty cash? He wrote the checks. He tallied the vouchers and balanced the books. If he was dipping into the till, it would easily go unnoticed since no one was double-checking him.
He cocked his head. You have anything to support that theory?
Sure, I said. The guy is young, a flashy dresser, maintains an expensive East Side apartment. He claims to have seen Quentin Beasley out on the town, which means he's out on the town himself. He mentions seeing him with several women, which means he goes out as a regular thing.
Winston Delmar, I mean.
He's the only witness the police have. There's no corroboration. If he'd been siphoning off money and attributing it to Beasley, he could have killed Lowell perfectly well.
Anything else?
Plenty. He also mentioned seeing Beasley in OTB. He says Beasley always played long shots, an idea he characterizes as stupid, which indicates, one, the guy's familiar with OTB, and two, he knows enough about horse racing to ridicule a betting style, which means he probably gambles himself. He also knows all about the gun. He knows what kind it is, what caliber it is, where it was kept. He also knows the police will be able to tell who fired it. He brings that up to poo-poo the idea Lowell could have fired him himself, says the police will be able to tell Lowell didn't fire the gun. He doesn't mention the paraffin test by name, but he knows there is a test, which would be in his mind if he'd been the one to fire the gun and had been careful to wear gloves when he did so.
Interesting, Richard said.
The idea the bookkeeper could have done it?
No, the fact you didn't present it to me.
What you just told me shows you've given it some thought, yet you come in here and advance the theory the corpse is the embezzler, which any fool could see is far less likely.
And why do you do that? Because you actually suspect the bookkeeper. That's your own little pet theory. But you're afraid if you offer it, I'll reject it. So you withhold it and let me come up with it myself, figuring that I'll think it's my theory and I'll be happy with it. Richard nodded. I find that very interesting. So did I, since that was exactly why I hadn't offered the bookkeeper as a suspect. Well put, Richard. What do you think of the theory? I find your ruse, however transparent, nonetheless effective. The bookkeeper certainly seems an excellent red herring.
Red herring?
Richard waved it away. Let's not get involved in semantics. He's an ideal suspect, one I will probably use. Not that we'll need it.
Oh, why not?
We have an alibi witness.
Cindy Summer chewed gum in a way that defined the word cheap. It was as if she'd seen a gun mall in a 50s B-movie and never gotten over it. Which was too bad, because Cindy was an attractive young woman who ordinarily would have had a lot to recommend her, but it was hard to get past the gum.
Or the jewelry. Cindy wore a lot of jewelry. Rings, necklaces, bracelets. And I am using the plurals advisedly. Cindy wore several of each item as if not trusting one to do the job. Unlike the gum, the jewelry did not make her look cheap. It occurred to me it would have cost a lot of petty cash.
That's right, Cindy said. Quentin was with me.
And when was this?
Yesterday afternoon.
From what time on?
She batted her eyes. What time do you need?
It's not a question of what we need. It's a question of what's true.
Why?
I blinked. The gum was disconcerting. Was she really as dumb as she looked, or actually rather smart?
I decided to give her the benefit of the doubt. We need to know what really happened, so we can plan our defense accordingly. You're not talking to the police. You're talking to me. You don't have to sell me a story. Just give me the facts. That's for starters. The other reason you got to tell the truth is the assistant district attorney. He'll rip you to shreds if you don't. In which case, Quentin Beasley is history. You're his alibi. If his alibi cracks, he's gone. It doesn't matter if he's innocent or not. The jury won't listen to anything after that. You understand?
She popped her gum at me, made a face.
Don't be stupid. Of course I understand. You don't want to tell me what you need? Fine, we'll do it your way. When was Quentin Beasley with me?
Yesterday afternoon, from after work, until he went to work this morning.
He spent the night?
Yes, he did. Are you horribly shocked?
I think my heart can take it. Has he done so before?
Yes, if it's any of your business.
It will be the assistant district attorney's.
Does he live here?
No, he doesn't. But he does stay over occasionally.
That's right.
And last night was one of those occasions?
Yes, it was.
What time did he get here?
Right after work.
He came over straight from work, took me out to dinner.
Where?
Huh? Where did you go to dinner?
Oh, a little restaurant down the block. I forget the name. We often eat there.
You often eat there and you forget the name?
Hey, it's not like it has a neon sign. It's a little hole-in-the-wall place. I can get the name if you want. If you think it'll back up my story. But the fact is, I eat there all the time and I don't know the name.
And you did last night?
That's right.
Who waited on you?
I beg your pardon?
If you eat there all the time, you must be familiar with the waiters and waitresses. I wonder if you could pick out the one who served you.
Well, I can't. I didn't even notice.
Why would I?
Was it a man or a woman?
I didn't notice.
Yeah, well, I bet they noticed you.
And it will be my job to find the one who waited on you, to corroborate your story.
Fine, you do that. We were there, and that's the truth.
They also might remember what time you were there.
Well, that's better than I can do. I don't wear a watch, see?
She held out her wrists, which proved nothing. They contained so many bracelets, any number of watches could have been hidden among them. I decided to take her word for it.
All right, I said. Do you have a clock in your apartment?
Of course.
Good. What time was it when Quentin Beasley got there after work?
I have a clock. I wasn't watching it.
I'm not that kind of person.
Well, can you fix the time from something else? Like, were you watching a TV program?
No, I was taking a nap. The doorbell rang. It was Quentin. He'd come over straight from work.
You have no idea what time?
No, you'll have to ask him.
But it must have been pretty early.
Why?
She popped her gun, smiled.
What time was his partner killed?
If Quentin Beasley's girlfriend didn't inspire confidence,
The man himself inspired even less. I met him the next day in Richard's office, going over the facts of the case, when Richard had me report on what I'd found. Nothing I'd found prepared me for Quentin Beasley. Until I met our client, I thought of Winston Delmore as a flashy dresser. Quentin Beasley made him look like a bum. His tie probably cost more than my whole suit. Beasley was a handsome man with a boyish face that probably would have looked totally sympathetic if his features weren't a little too angular. I wondered what Richard would do about that. Beasley listened attentively while I went over what I'd found. "Well," Richard said, "what do you make of that?" "A fine job," Beasley said. "Well presented." "I wasn't asking you to comment on his performance," Richard said. "How about the facts of the case?"
"I think he has them accurately," Beasley said.
"Sorry about Cindy, though. She ought to remember what time I got there."
"And what time was that?" Richard said.
Beasley raised his eyebrows. "We have a time of death yet?"
"We don't. The cops may."
"For the record," Beasley said, "I left work early. I got up to Cindy's apartment before 5.
"That's not what the bookkeeper says," I pointed out.
"Yes, but he's lying," Beasley said. He looked at Richard. "Isn't that the theory? The bookkeeper's lying because he's actually guilty."
"It certainly could have happened that way," Richard said.
Beasley spread his arms. "Well, there you are. If the bookkeeper's lying about tipping Freddie off to a petty cash shortage, he could be lying about when I left work."
"Yes, he could," I said. "His particular lie is that he went home at 5 and you and Mr. Lowell stayed behind."
"Just the opposite," Beasley said. "I went home and Freddie and Winston stayed."
"And what time was that?"
Quentin Beasley frowned, turned to Richard. "Is he supposed to be questioning me?"
"No, he's not," Richard said.
"Stanley often exceeds his authority. I've tried to break him of the habit. Stanley, more facts and less interrogation, if you please."
"Certainly," I said. "The facts are, Cindy Summer is a nice girl, but she isn't going to help us with the time element. She also isn't going to help us with the jewelry."
"Jewelry?"
"Yes, she wears a lot of it. Enough that it attracts attention. Practically demands it. If she wears that much in court, the prosecutor is going to want to know where it came from." I turned to Quentin Beasley. "If it turns out you bought her any, he's going to insinuate it came from petty cash."
Beasley shrugged. "Let him insinuate. He can't prove it."
"Maybe not," Richard said, "but there's no reason to push it in his face. We can tone down the jewelry on the stand."
"Even so, he'll go after the petty cash," I said. "The bookkeeper's prepared to testify about the petty cash vouchers and the bogus receipts."
"Which we are prepared to deflect," Richard said. "These vouchers are computer-generated and unsigned. They could have been prepared by anyone, including and especially the bookkeeper himself."
"That's right," Beasley said. "They can't tie me to that. And even if they could, those receipts aren't bogus."
I blinked. "I beg your pardon?"
"What's bogus about the receipts? They're absolutely genuine."
I blinked again. My mind was racing, and I didn't like where it was going. "Winston Delmar doesn't claim the receipts aren't genuine. He says the expenses they're covering aren't legitimate. He claims you got a bunch of receipts and added them up to cover the shortage. For instance, one receipt is from Tower Records for about $50. It's written up as office equipment. He figures you threw that receipt in to cover money you'd taken."
"Yeah, well, that shows how much he knows," Beasley said. "You think Tower Records carries nothing but CDs? It has answering machine tapes. It has computer programs."
He shrugged. "I see nothing unusual about that." Richard said, "What's the matter, Stanley? You don't look well."
"It must be something I ate," I said.
"Well, Mr. Beasley, you're saying the Tower Records receipt is legit?"
Beasley tugged at his expensive tie, sniffed arrogantly, cocked his head.
"Sure, why not? Let him prove it isn't."
He smiled, shrugged.
"What's the big deal?"
"No big deal," I told him. Alice got right to it.
"So what you gonna do?"
"I don't know."
"Uh-huh," Alice said. She adjusted the flame under the frying pan in which she was simmering the shrimp curry. My wife is an excellent cook, and the aroma was out of this world. Almost made me forget my troubles.
Almost.
"I made a promise to McAuliffe."
"What did you promise him?"
"Huh? As I recall, you promised you'd let him know if your client was innocent."
"Right."
"Well, if he isn't innocent, you don't have to let him know."
"Alice,
what did you say you'd do if your client was guilty?"
"A advised Richard to cop a plea.
Did you do that?
I had, out of earshot of our client. Nonetheless, Richard had acted as I'd expected. One might have thought I'd suggested he gargle cyanide.
I told Richard he won't listen.
So you kept your promise. What's the big deal?
I've kept my promise within the strict technical limits of what was said. My position would hold up in court. That's not the point. I told McAuliffe if I could prove my client innocent, not in legal terms, but in terms that would satisfy him, I'd do it. I'm going to withhold this from him because I can't prove it in legal terms?
Alice sighed, shook her head.
Stanley, what do you want to do? You want to walk into McAuliffe's office, say, I got good news and bad news. The good news is I found out who did it. The bad news is it's my client.
That's not funny.
I'm not trying to be funny. I'm trying to be serious.
Is that what you want to tell McAuliffe?
I don't know what I want to tell McAuliffe. The fact is my client took the petty cash. I come up with a nice, reasonable alternative hypothesis for him that the bookkeeper actually did it.
But does he go along with it?
No. The guy's so arrogant and stupid that he misses the point and argues that the petty cash expenses were legit, which doesn't help him much with the bookkeeper insisting they weren't and with his partner dead. If the expenses were legit, why is his partner dead? The bookkeeper wouldn't have any motive to kill him either.
I got all that. Alice said, if Beasley insists the receipts are genuine, it means he took the money, which means he killed his partner.
Is that what you want to tell McAuliffe?
Not on your life. Because Richard's going to shut Beasley up, advance the theory the bookkeeper did it, and raise reasonable doubt. Toward that end, he will cross-examine McAuliffe as vigorously as possible and try to make him look like a fool.
You going to tell that to McAuliffe?
That's what I promised him I would.
Uh-huh, Alice said. She tasted the curry, added a dash of wine.
So what you're saying is you can't tell McAuliffe any of the facts of the case. All you're going to be able to tell him is, in your opinion, your client's guilty and Richard's going to humiliate him?
That's about it.
McAuliffe will not be happy to get such news. No kidding.
You might be better off saying nothing.
Decide what evidence you have is inconclusive and need not be acted upon.
I suppose. Alice turned off the flame, lifted the pan from the stove, spooned the curry over a platter of pasta. She set the platter on the table, looked at me.
So, she said, what you gonna do?
Sergeant McAuliffe was on the phone when I came in, instructing the detectives at some crime scene or other on what he wanted done with the evidence. When he saw me, he never missed a beat, just cradled the receiver on his shoulder and reached for a cigar. He unwrapped it, rolled it between his hands, and twirled it with his fingers while speaking rapid fire into the phone. When he was done, he slammed the receiver down with his left hand while holding the cigar with his right. He looked at me narrowly, as if searching for a clue. He didn't get one. He frowned, cocked his head.
Well, he said, what's up?
I hesitated. It would have been so easy just to tell him, as Alice had suggested, that my investigation was inconclusive. But I couldn't do that. I sighed, smiled and shrugged. I got good news and bad news.
Petty Cash Killing is copyrighted by Parnell Hall. Music for this podcast was composed and performed by Sam Kulik. Mixing and sound editing were done by Emily Giuliarano. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more intriguing mysteries like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.